Chapter 1 Stephen Maturin squared up to his writing desk once more. He'd been called away to attend to one of the ship's boys, who in the lightness of his heart had contrived to stun himself in the foretop by taking the maul from its place, tossing it to a considerable height, and so misjudging the revolutions as it fell that the massive head struck him down speechless and unnaturally pale. Stephen dressed the wound, such as it was, more bruise than blood and no bone broken, and said to his loblolly boy, "Tell Dr. Jacob when he comes back that this boy is to have no grog for the next 3 days, and tomorrow he may keep his hammock." Dr. Jacob, the surgeon's mate, was away visiting friends aboard the frigate's tender, the rapid and windwardly Chesapeake schooner Ringle, and Stephen glanced in her direction, fine on the starboard bow, before going down from the brilliance of noon to the comparatively sombre cabin that he shared with Captain Aubrey. He'd already written "My dear Christine" before he was called away, and he dated the letter "Surprise, at sea, in Magellan's Strait." At his first sitting down, he'd meant to tell her, with what skill he could command, of the extraordinary beauty of the weather, and of the strait generally so forbidding. He should certainly have spoken of the favourable wind that had allowed them to keep t'gallant sails abroad ever since the morning watch. But above all, he should have dwelt upon the happiness that filled the ship, homeward bound after a very long, arduous, and most uncommonly dangerous voyage. A well-found ship commanded by a right seaman, a well-liked, deeply respected fighting captain, who, moreover, was soon to hoist his flag. There was no secret about this. Jack Aubrey's first unrestrained cries of delight on receipt of the blessed order had not escaped his steward nor anyone else within a range of 20 yards, nor had the unwonted floods of rum, the feasts in cabin, gunroom, and midshipman's berth, and the sacred blue flag itself, the mark of a rear admiral, lay openly on the forecastle, shaded from too fierce a sun, from untimely drops of spray, by an awning, the sailmaker and his mates, the ship's tailor and his, titivating it with minute stitches, while every hand aboard added half an inch of seam around its ample verge. It was considered the handsomest ensign in the service. But for the moment, the flag was absent from Stephen's mind. Indeed, the mind itself was in a singular state of absence. Hesitation, even stupidity. Before being called to the wretched boy, he had known at least the general trend of the passages that were to follow the words that lay there before him. But now he was filled with doubt. And to give his wits time to settle and clarify, he mended his pen, clipping its tip with a minute pair of metal jaws made for the purpose, and trimming the sides with a lancet capable of splitting hairs. Yet the right free, easy, candid expressions would not come, though the Christine in question was very dear to him. Stephen had long practised medicine, a calling in which discretion is often of great importance, but for an even longer time, if time is to be measured by stress, he'd been an intelligence agent. And here discretion was of the very essence, since an unguarded word or step might lead to the agent's death and to the death, the often hideous death, of his friends and the destruction of their cause. He sat down, his expression still tolerably blank. He was a lean, middle-sized man, unremarkable, of mixed Catalan and Irish origin, but it was the tropical sun and the sea air that accounted for his dark complexion, not any mixture of Moorish blood. For although his birth was illegitimate, which weighed upon him, his ancestors had been Christians time out of mind. A man of something less than 40, though he looked older as his mind wrestled with the difficulties of giving the intelligent woman he longed to marry a coherent, plausible account of the Surprise's activities and of a present return mission accomplished. For as soon as Captain Aubrey joined the South African squadron in the River Plate, going aboard HMS Suffolk, taking command of her and hoisting, or causing to be hoisted, the flag, blue at the mizzen, her act would turn him into that glorious creature, a rear admiral. The likelihood, the virtual certainty, was that Surprise should return to England, carrying Jack Aubrey's official dispatch, two young men who were to pass for lieutenant, and a great number of papers and certificates from the boatswain, carpenter, gunner and purser, justifying the expenditure or replacement of almost every item in the ship's unbelievably complex gear, furnishings and supplies, from pistol flints to great round shot and innumerable blocks. There was also a flat, factual, unadorned account of the Surprise's meetings with the Chilean authorities and of her proceedings, together with volume after volume of her activity in charting and surveying the South American islands and coasts. She was one of the smaller frigates, carrying no more than 28 great guns, and although in the right hand she was an outstanding sailor, she had been sold out of the service when heavier craft were built, and Stephen had bought her. So there she was, eminently seaworthy and available for hire to the Hydrographical Service of the Admiralty, once Napoleon had been dealt with and the Western world was at something like peace. Her ostensible function was to survey and chart the little-known coasts and innumerable islands of the recently independent Republic of Chile, and to help form its navy, training the young officers. All this was perfectly avowable and even praiseworthy, but the voyage had other aspects that were never distinctly laid down in written orders, but that were implied and understood on either side. And here, total candour was wholly out of the question, so that Stephen's letter home could obviously not be all he wished. In the first place, through Stephen's innumerable connections, Jack had been appointed Commander-in-Chief of the Chilean Navy as well as Admiralty Hydrographer. But the frigate's voyage had been slow, very foul weather south of the Horn, and when she reached Chile she found that the situation had changed remarkably. Apart from anything else, she was met with a bewildering number of juntas, of more or less independent governing bodies belonging to widely differing political parties, one of which had appointed its own commander-in-chief, though all were obsessed by the fear of a Peruvian invasion by land or sea or both. Peru was still ruled by the Spanish king's viceroy in Lima, and it still possessed a powerful, well-trained navy. After a very great number of vicissitudes, changes of ministry and so on, it appeared to Jack that since his main duty, often expressed in London but never committed to writing, was to preserve the independent Chilean Republic, the best way of doing so, and at the same time of protecting his beloved infant Chilean navy, was to attack the Peruvians in their port of Callao, and, if possible, to cut out their powerful frigate Esmeralda, the heaviest, best-armed man-of-war on the Pacific coast of America. This he did with extraordinary success at the risk of his life, and he brought the Esmeralda back to Valparaiso. He was much flattered and caressed, but later he was treated very shabbily indeed. His men were not paid. They were denied their prize money from various sources, and upon some pretext his ship was threatened with impoundment. Yet though Jack sometimes behaved like a simpleton by land, and though he was often swindled ashore, he was sea-wise. And having provisioned and stored his ship with the basic supplies needed to carry her at least to some port in the Argentine, he handed the Chileans an ultimatum. Either his men must have their due by a given date, or he should sail away. They were not paid, and he did sail away. Yet although the Surprise's voyage had something of the appearance of a failure, in fact, The Spanish hold on South America was broken. And although this hadn't been the Admiralty's direct order, the result gave immense satisfaction in the proper quarters. Furthermore, Jack had on board a singularly amiable and gifted young man, the unacknowledged but much beloved illegitimate son of Prince William, Admiral the Duke of Clarence, a zealous sailor, and almost certain to be king after his brother's death. Clarence had a great respect for Captain Aubrey. Some of Jack's actions were indeed extraordinarily brilliant, and through Dr. Maturin, who had treated His Highness for a variety of disease, mostly discreditable, had begged Jack to take the youth on this voyage, and young Hanson had distinguished himself as much as any loving naval father could have wished, cutting the Esmeralda's cable and carrying her out under fire. Yet even this wasn't all. On the Pacific coast, Jack and Stephen had met with a small, stout vessel filled with fellow members of the Royal Society, two of whom, ornithologists, were determined to cross the narrow isthmus of Panama and return to London by the Atlantic. And these excellent creatures agreed to take Jack's dispatches. The news of his famous victory and the preservation of Chile back to the Admiralty, then in the process of forming a South African squadron. Maturin and his chief, the head of naval intelligence, had long since established a system of rapid communication across the Andes, and it was thanks to this arrangement that Jack received the Admiralty's beautiful reply, a signal requiring him to proceed to the River Plate, there to go aboard HMS Suffolk, taking command of her and hoisting his flag blue at the mizzen that had spread such happiness throughout the ship. Yet although the ephemeral Chilean ministry had fallen to be replaced by one of its many rivals, the satisfaction that might have been supposed to accompany an assured independence was by no means general. There were many Chileans who regretted their old friends and their declared policies. Furthermore, the feeling wasn't confined to Chile. There were many Chilean refugees, and many of their Argentinian friends who had resented the Englishmen's presence, and who now even more bitterly resented their absence. To say nothing of those many, many Argentinians who so clearly remembered the British capture of Buenos Aires, and the even greater number of those who looked upon them as heretics, given to cursing the Holy Father almost every day. Both Maturin and Jacob had caught wind of this feeling, both in Chile and during their very beautiful passage of the strait. And in the afternoon before they were to put into San Pedro, a small sealing and fishing port at the bottom of an inlet on the northern shore, with some sheltered arable land behind it, famous for potatoes and cabbages on the one hand, and prodigious mussels and crayfish on the other, Stephen said, "My dear Jack, in the backwoods of America they say that an evil reputation is like an inextinguishable debt, that we've been so maligned on the Pacific coast that it might be prudent to arm the boats, or even to hail the ship so close to the strand that your great guns command the whole settlement. In the event the few inhabitants of San Pedro didn't offer to challenge a reasonably powerful man of war moored broadside on before their settlement, nor the powerful cutlass-bearing seamen who walked along the quay. Yet although most of the citizens were at least partly Tierra del Fuegans, and although none of them could have had any first-hand knowledge of recent events, they were sullen and unfriendly, yielding only a few indifferent potatoes and wilted cabbages at an exorbitant price. However, the ship did top up her water from a clear, free-running stream, no great distance from its parent glacier, and still, with this blessed westerly breeze, she pursued her long, twisting course through the strait. Jack, Hansen and Daniel perpetually taking bearings, soundings, views of the shore, icy to the southwards, often raining to the north, and establishing a truly remarkable chart. Stephen, who had no abilities whatsoever in this direction, confined himself to his medical duties, of course, slight though they were, with a healthy crew and such an able assistant as Jacob, to watching and sometimes dissecting the birds, mammals and marine plants and creatures of the strait, and much of this he added to his letter to Christine, she being the only woman of his acquaintance who knew the difference between a jackass penguin and a macaroni, and who delighted in the knowledge. She would also delight in the knowledge, reflected her lover, that these most inhospitable shores, often snowy on the south of the strait, always icy on the northern height, nevertheless sheltered at least one parrot or parakeet, a green bird with a fine red tail that flew in noisy groups in the beechwoods, and a minute hummingbird that could be seen sipping nectar from the fuchsias in Tierra del Fuego when the ship was on that side of the channel. He was reasonably well engaged with this letter one afternoon after dinner, when Jack, abandoning his fiddle, returned to his surveying. And Stephen, closing his passage on Port Egmont hens, often to be seen, lifted his head to Hansen's reiterated, "Sir, if you please." "Why, master dear," for Horatio Hansen was acting master of the ship, "I fear you've been waiting. I never heard you." "Not at all, sir. It was only that Dr. Jacob feared you might have overlooked your appointment." At this moment, a tiny chime could be heard in the bosom of both, for each possessed wonderfully accurate repeating watches. The one a replacement of the minute timepiece that Stephen had given to Christine, the other Prince William's parting gift to his son. "God love us all, and may I be forgiven," cried Stephen, leaping up. "It's 3:30. I'm late." "Mind your step, sir," said Hansen, steadying him. "It's blowing up uncommon stiff from the west-nor-west. Has veered 3 points in 30 minutes, and Ringle is reefing hard." They made their way forward to the fairly well-lit and now vacant space in the sick berth, which the surgeons reserved for anatomising. For the past few days they'd been busy on a singular, probably undescribed, dolphin. And as they carefully pared away, separated and described the muscular parts, so they gave them to the cook's mates standing there with buckets. The bones they kept for themselves. But today they'd been obliged to stop. The frigate's motion was too great, and in spite of their skill and care, their cutting was by no means accurate with the deck so very much awash. "We're making ready to lie to, sir," said Hansen in his ear, "and the captain says he'll pass the word when it's fit for you to come on deck. In the meantime, he desires you and Dr. Jacob will stand by to deal with casualties." The first, to his own infinite shame, was Harding, the senior lieutenant, a straightforward fibula and tibia, which they very soon splinted and bound up. Then came the usual series of bumps and bruises, diminishing as the furious gust blew itself out, and ending with the captain's compliments brought by awkward Davies, and if now they chose to come on deck, they would see a sight like a madhouse's washing day, God love us. "What rigging we have is fair stuffed, stuffed with fucking bull parrots and God knows what, which I have to bring you up and cop 300 lashes if you fall." Stephen had, of course, heard of the South American parrots, and he'd often seen their little troops, but only from a distance, identifiable from their manner of flight and from their brilliant colour, so very unlike the general drabness of the strait. And so eager was he to reach the first entangled in the leeward shrouds that he would certainly have gone over the side but for Davy's powerful restraining hand. And it was not only parakeets, though they, of course, were the most obvious and the most eagerly coveted by Hans, who were perfectly accustomed to the African race. Even more spectacular and even more wounding were the many kinds of minute birds, including Stephen's Tierra del Fuego honeysucker, that had been dashed against the rigging or the remaining sails with such force that in spite of their lightness they were quite shattered. And as the blast died away, deck, lighter rigging and scuppers were jewelled all over with their pitiful but still brilliant fragments. Some of the more solid birds, particularly the parakeets and some red-crested woodpeckers, could be revived and patched to some degree, but on the whole it was a most dispiriting task, the more so since there was very little hope of identification in most cases. Still, Stephen, seconded by his mate, did what they could in the way of retrieval, mostly of skins, exceptionally difficult on that scale, and tiny bones. They took quantities of notes, and they did a little something to increase their knowledge of this almost untouched avifauna. For 2 and even 3 days after that furious blast, the waters of the strait remained strikingly turbulent, particularly in the narrows, and great beds of kelp torn loose from their bases floated on every hand, sometimes endangering the rudder, sometimes checking the ship's way, and always disturbing birds, cetaceans, and ordinary level-headed fishes. Nevertheless, in spite of kelp, unexpected currents, and strange vagaries of tide off a number of headlands, the ship's whole passage of the strait before she turned north, well out in the full Atlantic with the Cape of the 11,000 Virgins broad on larboard bow, lasted only 3 hours more than 9 days. "We're making pretty good time," said Jack, "and I think we may look into Port Desire and Bahia Blanca without keeping the Admiral waiting. We was not to sail till the 12th. Would you ever tell me, has he a numerous fleet?" "Pretty considerable. 3 squadrons, of which ours, the Blue, is of course the smallest. But, Stephen, do not think for a moment that I complain. Of course it is the smallest, being Blue. But had it been half the size, I should still have given my right hand for it. Good Lord above, a flag at last! It was amazingly kind of them. Don't think for a moment that I complain, dear Stephen. It hadn't occurred to me at all, said Stephen. Then he went on, "Since my ill-bred questioning is so prosperous, and to be sure it is very ill-bred indeed, may I ask why you mean to stop at these South American ports, when I understood you to say we could sail home with what was in the hold?" "Knife of fresh water and meat, of course, to say nothing of vegetables and fruit. We could probably have got home, of course, but verminous, half-starved and rotten with scurvy. But that would have been a desperate stroke in a goddamn desperate situation, one that a man couldn't stand. But now the case is altered. I'm to join Lord Leighton in the River Plate, and I make no doubt, for he's a very active officer, as I know full well, that he will take the fleet down and across to the Cape with the utmost dispatch, and I prefer to be ready to weigh at the first hint of a signal, with the last cask of biscuit aboard and a well-fed, active, healthy crew. No shore leave will be allowed. But my dear surprise is to go home, as you very well know, with your dispatches and all our letters home, and once there she reverts to the station of a private ship. Ever since we left Magellan Strait and steered north, the people have become increasingly aware of this, and the joy that filled the surprise has sensibly diminished day by day. You know how unhappy our men from Shelmiston were when they were paid off with the peace, and how wonderfully they revived when you took them aboard. Certainly, I know it very well. And I'm going to use all what influence I may have to ease her back into the service. The squadron's pitifully short of frigates. And since I understand that our duty down there is the protection of the Indian and Chinese trade, nothing could be more useful than a nimble, weatherly ship-like Surprise, and I beg you will do the same. But even if we cannot succeed directly, I am allowed my bargemen and a good many other followers. I've little doubt that I shall house a score or so of the rest among my friends. And for those that are left, if there are any left, merchant shipping has revived wonderfully, and a seaman with a good character from the Royal Navy will not wait long for a berth. Just as it had been Hansen who first sighted Cape Pilar on the eastward leg at the very opening of the strait, so it was his particular friend Daniel, who, spending his watch below in the fore-topgallant cross-trees, caught the leading mark for Port Desire in his glass, checked it twice, and called, "On deck there! On deck! St. Paul's Rock, 12 to 15 miles on the larboard bow. Dim. Comes and goes." It came and went because of a heavy sea inshore that covered it entirely from time to time, if not with green water, then with foam. And although the rollers moderated somewhat inshore, the frigate had an uneasy time mooring in the southern turbulences this side of the primitive mole-dirty water from some untimely flash flood. "I once saw a rare here some way inland," observed Stephen, as he and Jacob were walking along the mean street, obscurely strewn with drowned dogs, to speak to the port captain about water and vegetables. "The South American ostrich, somewhat smaller than the African bird. A most inferior creature." "Ah," said Jacob. And then, "I believe this must be the captain's house." The port captain half rose when they came in, but he was far from cordial, and he said that he couldn't recommend the town water after this diabolic flood and all the nastiness it brought. Stephen spoke about the country inland, a hacienda he'd visited, the kindness of the people. He and the others were, of course, speaking Spanish, and after a while the port captain said that there happened to be a clean spring at no great distance, but they would have to pay the proprietor a fee. "It is not for myself, you understand. For my own part, I am astonishingly generous, generous to a fault, even lavish." He spoke of his faults at some length, and then, having called for coffee, he asked, in a confidential, almost affectionate tone, "Why, they, obviously old and rancid Christians, consorted with those vile heretics." And when Stephen made the usual gesture of extreme poverty, rubbing thumb over knuckle, the captain shook his head, saying, "Ah, when the devil drives. I shall send my boy with your men to Anita's spring, but they must be very respectful to her, and pluck off their hats. Her sister Helena, the werewolf, will provide cabbages." So she did. Fine, upstanding plants, but without the least appearance of pleasure, or, perhaps understandably, of common humanity. And both in these transactions and in a few others along the edge of the market, the Surprises noticed a sullenness, a strong inclination to stare, muttering, while after some of their transactions the sellers could be seen to wash the coins or rub them industriously in the grit underfoot. Even if the Surprise, with her singularly fine lines and her 36-gun frigate's towering mainmast, had not been so recognisable to a sailor's eye, her ensign would have identified her almost anywhere in the world. For on reverting to her function as a surveying vessel under Admiralty command, she had also reverted to the white ensign. At Bahia Blanca, their next port of call, Stephen, who was the natural emissary on such occasions, reported the same sullen apathy. No, unmingled with a reluctance to sell, exorbitant prices, and injurious expressions. "Brother, you're playing at least half a tone too high," said Jack that evening as they soared away after an early supper. "Am I?" cried Stephen, looking attentively at his fingers and twanging the string. "So I am. I do beg your pardon. It's the shrill bitterness of my soul that makes it weigh out, I fear. I'm so sorry to impose these odious duties upon you, Stephen. Pray take a sup of port. But, you know, of course, you know only too well that when you and all your people have been without long enough, you will descend to the basest means to relieve your wants."
"I'm not sure that the response is altogether civil."
"But be that as it may, I will tell you, Jack, that if they're bad in Port Desire and worse than Bahia, they're likely to be downright outrageous in the River Plate, where we are to meet the South African ships. Yet, if I'm not mistaken, we're likely to be there well before Lord Leighton, well before even your little squadron."
"What the devil do you mean by my little squadron? It's a perfect and normal squadron. Rather large than otherwise. 2 ships of the line, apart from Suffolk. A 50-gun ship. 2 considerable sloops of war. Hush, hush, Jack. Never fly into a passion, soul," cried Stephen, seeing that his friend was seriously annoyed. "So you must know, after all this time, that we use little as an endearment. Ameliorative term, as one says, my little puss, to a handsome Amazon that weighs 15 stone in her shift. So we arrived, you follow me now, well before his lordship, whom God preserve, and our natural allies, all because of our commendable zeal. Now let me beg you for all love to moor your ship close in against the southern shore, for so much as an egg. An egg! For in a considerable city, fanaticism can swell to a most surprising and horrible extent." At the end of the particularly grave adagio, Jack put down his bow and said, "Should you dislike it very much if we were to leave Bahia out of our plans? Our water and the cabbages have held out uncommon well, and I had as soon push on quietly, if you understand me, to the River Plate, where there's a great resort of merchantmen and all sorts of people that supply their needs, chandlers, smiths and the like. You're not dependent on the local werewolf. Not that I have anything to say against werewolves. The gentlewoman was perfectly civil, and her cabbages have stood up admirably. They should not dislike it at all. Bahia has, by all accounts, some tolerable strands, but nothing in the way of lakes or marshland within striking distance. Jacob and I have an immense amount of sorting, reconstituting, classifying and preserving to do, and I had as soon sail on northwards, quietly, as you put it so well, quietly putting our collections in order. Quietly indeed they sailed along, with gentle breezes that wafted them generally northwards at something in the nature of 5 miles in the hour, northwards to even warmer seas. Little activity was called for, apart from the nice adjustment of the sails, and although the exact routine of the ship was never relaxed, nor her very strict rules of cleanliness, these long, sunny days with a soldier's wind seemed to many the ideal of a seaman's life. Regular, steady, traditional meals, with the exact allowance of grog, hornpipes in the last dog watch, the deep melody of the doctor's cello from the cabin, and the cheerful sound of the gunroom's dinner. The future lost in a haze somewhere north of the equator. So the golden days went by.
and Stephen's mound of tiny skins mounted up, very carefully dried and treated against mites, against the voracious cockroaches that no amount of sulphurous fumigation could eliminate from the ultimate depths of the hold, their survivors breeding with extraordinary rapidity. By the time they were in flying fish water again, the Surprise and her people had settled down to this very agreeable form of life. Some few cases of sunburn and alleged moonpall by night to occupy Paul's keeping and Maggie, and a series of quite deep, painful wounds, or rather hook-billed bites from those parakeets that didn't choose to be tamed. But for once, no steady dosing for the pox. With a perfectly competent, conscientious, but by no means tyrannical First Lieutenant, Jack Aubrey and his clerk could devote their hours to gathering all the scattered surveying material from the various notebooks and journals and cast it into the regular form most valued by the Hydrographical Department. They were quite near the end of their work on the immense South Pacific Crescent, at the northern tip of the Chonos Archipelago, which Jack had surveyed in freezing drizzle with a team of zealous and remarkably amiable young Chilean officer cadets, when the expected news came below. With the master's duty, Mr. Wells begged to tell Captain Aubrey that the leading marks for the River Plate were clear from the masthead, almost due nor-nor-west. They were clearer still by the last dog watch, when the declining sun lit them from behind, and in the morning the Surprise was well into the whole vast bay. All day long, with a gently favouring breeze, they sailed up it until both shores could clearly be seen, and a fair amount of shipping, but never a sign of a man of war. Father, with no more than her foretopsail now, a pause for dinner. And drinking his coffee on deck afterwards, Jack said to Stephen, "May I ask you and Dr. Jacob to run up to the island with Wantage and make sure that our salute will be returned? This reception is so very curious that I should like to make it quite certain. Mr. Harding, please be so good as to have the blue cutter put over the side." The island was the chief of the many administrative centres. It was from the battery high on the seaward cliff that salutes were answered, and usually the place was like a fairly busy hive with customs, quarantine, and harbour dues officials swarming all over it, together with soldiers, sailors, marines, and those grave gentlemen in long black coats, black scabbarded swords, black neckcloths and black wigs, who were said to be very high in the administration. At present the place was singularly quiet, almost motionless, and since the salute was rarely returned without a good deal of bustle, the silence made all hands uneasy. It was known throughout the service that an unreturned salute was practically a casus belli. In any event, it was the gravest insult, and one that would put an end to all communication with the shore, and to fire a salute without assurance that it would be returned was strictly forbidden. The question didn't often arise, but in this case the atmosphere was so uncommon that Jack didn't intend to run the risk. Yet, while the coxswain was summoning his boat's crew, Harding said to Jack, "Forgive me, sir, but I believe I see a craft clearing from the lee side." "Yes, sir," lowering his glass. "I think it's one of their medicos and a couple of dirty mates." He peered again. "Yes, a dirty, ill-looking crew in a dirty, ill-looking craft." They didn't improve on closer acquaintance. At 50 yards from the frigate's side, a man stood up and bawled, "Quarantine!"
Harding had a ladder put over, and the party's leader, wearing a black coat and a yellow wig, followed by a youth with an inkhorn, came aboard quite nimbly.
"Dr. Kental," said the man in a very loud voice. "Health! Speak Portuguese?"
Wantage, who was fluent in the language, made as though to answer, but Stephen checked him.
"I am the surgeon of this ship, sir," he said in Latin. "Dr. Maturin at your service. I do not have the pleasure of speaking Portuguese, but I should be happy to answer any questions you choose to ask in Latin. And so will my colleague, Dr. Jacob."
Dr. Kental put as good a face on it as he could, and with more ease than the company expected, he repeated a list of disorders by class. Exantematici, criticae, phlogisticae, dolorosae, quietales, motoriae, suppressoriae, evacuatoriae, deformes, vicia. Stephen considered all these one by one, shaking his head after due reflection, and then inviting their guests to come and view what invalids the ship possessed. Pulsekeeping and Maggie had had plenty of time. Their few patients, all with mill strains or broken bones, apart from one with raging toothache to be dealt with tomorrow, when his particular friend the armourer had finished a powerful pair of forceps to his own satisfaction, were correctly rigid in their cots, washed pink, brushed and incapable of movement, almost of drawing breath, so tight strained were the sheets. Dr. Kental was much impressed, much gratified by a draught of rum, happy to accept the compliment of a neatly cased French amputating saw, and perfectly willing to give Surprise a clean bill of health. He also stated that, in his considered opinion, the fort wouldn't hesitate to answer the ship's salute with exactly the same number of guns. Having sorted his Latin with some care while he finished his glass, he told Stephen that he was an anti-clerical, that he had nothing to do with the public burning of heretics, and that he dared say there were very good men everywhere, among Jews, for example, or blacks, or even worse. "Sir," said Wantage in Stephen's ear as the Rio boat pulled away, "his mates that didn't go below with the doctor told me there was a rare old rumpus in the town last night when some of the people from a bark out of Boston, the Boston in the colonies, stood up at a vigil and said it was great nonsense to say you were allowed only one wife at a time. Look at King Solomon, they said, and it was taken very much amiss. Then one of them called out that he didn't give a fig for the Pope of Rome, and fighting broke out. They said five Protestant houses were set on fire, and it might be much worse tomorrow with the arrival of the legate."
"What's a legate?" asked Jack when Stephen told him of this.
"In England they were usually called nuncios," said Stephen, but in answer to a very severe look he added, "an ambassador, you might say, often plenipotentiary."
"Well, I hope the silly villains have got it wrong," said Jack with a look of strong dissatisfaction. "This is the very last moment to become religious and start looking for stakes, gunpowder and what do you call those things?
Sanbenitos."
"Just so, Sanbenitos. All we want to do is to fill up our water, buy a few fresh provisions and no doubt some wholesome fruit. We don't want to be racked, scourged and burnt. We get plenty of that at sea, free gratis and for nothing. And pay our compliment to the governor." "Oh, that Suffolk would come in, followed by the rest of the Blue Squadron, then by Lord Leighton with his ships, and hey for Cape Town with never a papist in sight for the next 10,000 miles. I beg pardon, dear Stephen," he added, looking earnestly into Stephen's face. I really didn't mean to be unkind or personal.
I am sure you did not, my dear, said Stephen. Pray, when do you mean to start the salute?
Just as soon as the gunner tells the officer of the watch that all's right and ready, and the officer of the watch tells Harding to his astonishment that we're all ready. Then, when I've begged Harding to proceed, we shall, with luck, hear that fine measured boom, boom, boom. 12 guns is usual for Rio, and I know that Harding's having the irons heated. For, you see, with a red-hot iron in your touch-hole, you cannot misfire and have one of those embarrassing pauses in the solemn round. He's as eager as I am to have the barkey as trim as the royal yacht on occasions like this.
The day itself was by no means as trim as it would have been, but for the legate's visitation. Yet even so, at tea-time, Killick came in, followed by Grimble, a procession of two bearing the tea-tray, a great Spanish salver captured long ago, and a reasonable amount of anchovy toast, tea-cakes, and a noble muffin. Jack took tea seriously, as well he might, being so much exposed to the elements. Indeed, he finished the two men's muffins single-handed, and then, wiping his buttery fingers, he directed an intelligent, almost a political look at Stephen, paused for a while, and then said, in substance, exactly what Stephen had expected him to say. There are, as you know better than I, far better indeed, a good many of our people are... Here he hesitated, trying to find which was least offensive. Papists? Romans? Mumbo-jumbo certainly wouldn't do. People of the old faith sounded obsequious. Most of them are Irish, of course, though quite a few come from the English North Country. And then there are the mere foreigners, that's to say, the foreigners. There is something to be said for the word Catholics. It's in general use in Ireland. Just so, thank you, Stephen. Well, in strange towns you quite often lead your band to a place where they hear what they expect to hear. A place where they're quite at home.
Just so. And if you recall, I nearly always bring them back to the ship sober.
Indeed you do. Thoughtful, contemplative, and, as you say, dead sober. Now, it just happened to cross my mind that, was you to take them all to the cathedral, well, I have no doubt the legate will be pontificating, as is but right and proper, and if they were to be perfectly neat, fit to pass an admiral's inspection, most uncommon Solomon pious, if you understand me, and was they to sing out good and hearty in the right places, it might tend to create a good impression and persuade His Holiness that we were not all a band of gin-sodden rapparees given over entirely to whoredom and things I don't like even to mention. I hope you don't find my suggestion offensive, Stephen, for it is only a suggestion, to say, not in any sense an order. A very good suggestion, too. And I shall pass the word about my fellow papists, letting them know, among other things, that it is for the honour of the ship that we should not all be blacked with a whole number of brushes. Lutherans, bigots, church burners, destroyers of monasteries, sodomites, and a number of other words that will instantly occur to your mind. But first, with your permission, I will go ashore and gather what information I can. At present I swim in a sea of unknowing. The only thing that is at all clear is that upon the whole they don't love us as much as they should. What he said was quite true. Neither the British seamen nor the Royal Navy seemed really popular. Quite early in the morning a large scow filled with much of the city's night soil heaved its massy burden overboard so close to the frigate's side that her paintwork was horribly fouled,
and her yardarms much endangered. All this to the cry, "Filthy sods!" which the Portuguese had obviously learnt from a merchantman, and which they repeated with unflagging zeal for a very long time, stopping only when some facetious hands from an incoming trawler started throwing their more putrid cargo onto Surprise's deck. The trawler, curiously enough, was garlanded, if not with roses, then at least with some bright pink tropical flowers. Nor was she alone in this. Very considerable numbers of other fishing craft, from whalers down to one-rod tunny men, came swarming up the bay. During a pause in the hoots, the pelting, and the obscene gestures, Stephen and Jacob returned, unhurt, unmolested, undefiled. They did indeed look very like foreigners, poor souls. They asked Jack to come below, and in the cabin Stephen said, "Sir, I shall speak for us both, if I may, although Dr. Jacob's information is of greater value than mine, and his connections far more varied. In the very first place, the extreme clerical, what I might call, right wing, means to overthrow the governor and the government tonight or tomorrow. The legate, who has great influence with the very large service population, and above all with their leaders, is here to prevent, or at least to soften, this movement. The ultra-clericals have little in the way of armed support, and that is one of the reasons why they have made so much of this alleged Protestant business, and why we were pelted with dung. May I say how extraordinarily wise you've been not to retaliate? To continue, this is the day upon which the fishing boats are blessed. A very considerable feast indeed, a holiday of obligation." He looked at his watch. "I shall not go on prating any longer, but let me beg you to come on deck now with your glass, and if necessary to go into the top to see the legate arrive at the top of the steps from which he blesses the fishermen and their craft." Jack Aubrey did exactly what he was asked to do, giving Jacob a hand at the last stage. And there they stood, all three, gazing out to starboard at the far, but not so very far, side of the harbour, where a noble flight of stairs led down to the water. At the side of the steps stood soldiers in scarlet cloaks, and on the water the boat's kedges dropped, sails stowed, floated quietly for their blessing. Suddenly, the prodigious, all-pervading sound of the vast crowd dropped to something not far from silence, instantly filled by the glorious sound of trumpets, and as the legate, a fine, tall, upright figure in a white gown, advanced to the head of the steps, the people cheered to the very vault of the sky. "By God, he's black!" said Jack Aubrey. And a moment later his face was contorted with emotion. "He's very happy," murmured Stephen. "Presently he'd come over." "Presently" was a strange word to use, but while it lasted, the legate blessed, marked boats by the score, by the hundred, with holy water, and finally, after an immense thunder of drums, he told the assembly that the ceremony had been accomplished. They might now sail with God. It was as much a dismissal as ita missa est. But although something like silence came down upon the bay, almost no one moved. They stood watching the legate's splendid barge as it pulled straight across to the Surprise. The legate came up the side like a right seaman and hurried across the deck to his father. "Dearest Sam, you haven't changed," said Jack as they clasped hands. Then Sam knelt and patted his father's feet, a gesture as natural as the sun. Then Stephen led his men forward, and they all kissed the legate's ring. We must go,
said Sam, lifting his ear to a distant bell.
But, sir, may I beg for my supper tonight?
I shall look forward to it extremely, said Jack. And he went below while he could still do so with a decent composure. In the close-packed community that made up the crew of a man of war, there was extremely little privacy. They ate, slept, washed, relieved themselves in public. In public, they were flogged, unless they happened to be officers. And in that case, a severe admonition was very soon made known throughout the ship. Each man and boy knew exactly what the others earned and how much the married men sent home. And although the officers sometimes had private means and were sometimes unwilling to speak of them, they also had servants who knew whether their masters were bearing hard up for Poverty Bay or spreading all canvas for Port Lavish itself. The paternity orders that had brought many hands aboard were the subject of often repeated wit. There were few surprises, therefore, who were much astonished at the very strong resemblance between the nuncio and his host. It was perfectly well known that the younger man was one of Mr. Midshipman Aubrey's indiscretions when, as a long-legged youth, he had served on the South African station, and that the boy, brought up by Catholic missionaries in Mozambique, had presented himself to his father in the West Indies, bearing the present of a charm, a juju, from his affectionate mother, that had kept Jack alive through some really desperate encounters. Killick was, of course, a fount, and a reasonable, honest fount, of information, much of it derived from Barrett Bondon, Jack's coxswain and valued friend, until he was killed in battle, a source of much greater value. From this general history, therefore, what newcomers there were in that long harbour watch learned that the good fathers, having taught Sam his letters and a considerable amount of Latin, the English he picked up with no sort of trouble, destined him for the minor orders, for nothing more because of his illegitimate birth. But Stephen Maturin, who, though a bastard himself, was very well connected, obtained a dispensation for the young man to whom he was particularly attached, and Sam had risen very fast indeed. To be sure, he was unusually intelligent and exceptionally good-natured, but he was also very black, shining black. And this was a time when a strong current of opinion in the church felt that the rapidly increasing black world should be given very much more attention. On merely practical side, the very, very large number of black men and women, slaves of or hired labourers, particularly in South America, must necessarily influence the balance of power in time. Father Panda, who was a natural-born linguist, had already done excellent work in Brazil, and now he was sent to the Argentine with greetings and perhaps some good advice to those who were, or were about to be, in power.